Hey there, I'm your host Alexis Newland and you're listening to The Brave Podcast. I am so happy you're tuning in today. Each week, a friend and I get together and talk about what makes them brave. So sit back, relax, grab your favorite cup of coffee or tea, and get ready for some engaging conversation. Welcome to another episode of The Brave Podcast. I'm your host Alexis and I am so glad that you're here to join in to listen today. My guests for this week are my friends, Sarah and Richard Harney. I met them back at Arizona State, and gosh, how many years has it been? 2003, 2004, maybe 2005? Sometime in the early 2000s, Sarah worked with me at our preschool where we helped teach kids, and I met Richard through her, and so we kind of became friends, and then life happened, moved away, and kind of kept up through Facebook. I've kind of been following their story because they have a daughter who has cystic fibrosis, and they're always been really open about that, what it's like to go through that, and how it's, and her preaching, and so it's been cool to kind of follow them. So I'm really glad that I asked them to be guests, and so I think you guys are going to absolutely love their interview. They're just so fun to like just kind of hang out with for an hour, and it kind of taught me to not let so much time go by and to actually connect with friends. At the time of this recording, it was like we were in the thick of the coronavirus and when everything started shutting down. And I kind of found like through that time that I've had this bigger desire to connect with people from my past. And so there too, and I'm so glad that I did that. So without further ado, here is my interview with Richard and Sarah Harney. Enjoy. Welcome to The Brave Podcast. I'm Alexis, and I am here with my friends Sarah and Richard Harney, and they're going to share their story with you guys today. So kind of you introduce yourselves and tell everybody why you're awesome and what you do and where you are.
So I am Sarah Harney, and I'm married to my husband.
Richard Harney.
We are high school sweethearts. We have been together for 20 years, and we've been married for 13.
Wow.
Yes, it's been that long. And we currently have 5 children, ages 12, 10, 8, 6, and almost 4.
Wow, you have a busy household.
Very, very busy household. It's very loud.
It's 14 years.
14 years?
Yeah.
Not till June.
Okay.
Yeah. 14. Well, it's not June yet.
Yeah, it's 14. It's
technically 13 still.
This is going to be fun.
I'm currently the worship leader at our church.
Okay.
So I've been doing that for the last 8 years.
Okay.
And I'm going to school right now to become a pastor, which
is
really
awesome.
Exciting.
Awesome. Very cool. Where are you going to school for that?
So actually I'm doing it online through the Christian Missionary Alliance, which is the church that, we're part of. So I'm doing that while trying to, you know, be a wife and mom to 5 kids and just balance all of that.
So you are very busy.
Yes. Very busy.
What made you want to become a pastor?
Actually, it's interesting. I never wanted to be in the ministry field, ever.
Okay.
I grew up in the church as a ministry kid, you know, first to arrive, last to leave.
Yeah.
And some stuff had happened in the church that hurt me, and so I just told myself I never wanted to be in the church. And actually, when I knew Alexis, I was so far from my faith. It was not something that I wanted to have in my life.
Okay.
But then we got pregnant with our miracle baby, and I just felt that call to go back to church, and that was 13 years ago.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's kind of a crazy journey, but through volunteering to be on the worship team and then my pastor asking me if I wanted to preach one day, I realized that I had a passion for it, and that's where I'm at.
I saw your video. What was that like to get up in front of your your congregation and preach? Like, how did you prep for it? How did it feel being up there?
It was terrifying. I've had to really die to myself because I hate making mistakes. So that means that I tend to live in my head a lot and I'm not an external or a verbal processor.
Okay.
So it took a lot for me to just trust that if God gave me a word, to believe it and deliver it. And I have a really amazing church family that embraces me and loves me through, you know, me learning how to do this. It's a blessing.
That is really cool.
Yeah. Right.
So I'm going to go back to how about of you two. How did you two meet? You guys are high school sweethearts, you said?
Yes. So I was a senior.
Yeah.
Sarah was a junior. And I was DJing some of the high school dances. And I knew her from other friends, and we hung out a few times this way and that way, just from other, you know, just different things. The first time I actually ever met her was on the soccer field, and she was on my team, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was cold out, and her shoelace came untied, and I went over and tied her shoe for her. And then that was just kind of one interaction there. And then we were doing a drug-free youth conference. Both of us were on staff, volunteered staff or whatever during high school. And she started singing one day. And that was when I knew that I wanted to be with her. But I was DJing a dance, and that was when I first asked her out if she wanted to hang out after the Halloween dance. And so that was our first official date hanging out. It was on Halloween.
Oh, okay.
So what he's leaving out is the fact that we were actually enemies.
What? Okay.
For him. He's leaving all of that out. He's making himself look really good right now, and that is not true. That is not true. I had dated his friend, and his friend had told me he loved me after 2 weeks, and at the age of 15, I was not ready to hear those words.
I can imagine.
So I broke up with him, and he and their friend group decided to terrorize me, make fun of me, and they called me bulldog because they said I looked like a bulldog. So what he's leaving out is the fact that we were mortal enemies, and I hated him.
Oh, wow.
Hated him. And it was that day that he tied my shoe in the pouring down rain where I was like, maybe he's not so bad after all.
So
keep your friends close, but keep your enemies closer, right?
Yeah. So knowing she hated you, what gave you the guts to ask her out? That's really fascinating.
Well, it was hearing her sing. That was when I fell in love with her.
Oh.
I heard her sing, and I realized that I wanted to be with her, and I didn't want to miss out on getting to know her further. And then I realized that my friend may have been a little overzealous and kind of a ding dong. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay. And so you guys are in Alaska now. How did you guys make it to Arizona State? Because that's where I met you.
So I went off to college after I graduated from high school. We kind of dated off and on while during her senior year and my first year of college, and then Sarah went to Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, and we dated on and off again. I was down in Coos Bay, Oregon, just west of Eugene, and I would make the 6-hour drive, and she would make the 6-hour drive to come and see each other. And then while she was at PLU, she realized that it wasn't working out for her. And her aunt and uncle were living in Phoenix, Arizona. And they said, you know what, why don't you come down here, get into Arizona State, come down here, do the nursing program, and leave him alone and leave him behind. And she said, well, that sounds great. And she told me, she goes, hey, you need to grow up. I'm going to Arizona State. I'm going to go down there and go to school. And, well, if you want to follow me and you want to grow up, you can, but you don't have to. But that would be it. And that was the time that I was like, well, maybe I should probably stop. I didn't have a walk with Christ at the time at all. And I was like, yeah, maybe I should stop drinking with my brother and his buddies and stop living in this basically a flop house with them. And maybe I should do something with my life. And I said, all right, fine, I'll follow you to Arizona. And she was very surprised. She didn't expect that to happen. She expected me to just stay behind and be like, all right, see you, bye.
I really thought this was my chance to drop dead weight. So I was just kind of like, he's never going to grow up. He's going to want to stay and party with his brother and all of their buddies. And I really thought this was my way out. I was shocked that he followed me to Arizona. I was shocked.
So I moved her down there. We got an apartment down there. I came back up to Alaska to finish working that semester while she started school at ASU. And that was before I left, I proposed to her. And so then we were engaged. And I came back down and we, December, January, something like that?
October.
And I came back down there and applied to Arizona State, and both of us are Sun Devil grads.
Yeah. I forgot, Sarah, that you were in nursing school and then you became a rec therapist. I forgot about that. Yeah.
It was actually because of you.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I applied to the nursing program, and I had one of the highest test results for math. But my reading portion was like a 3.8 level.
Okay.
And I was floored that, you know, thinking that math would be so much more important for them to focus on in the nursing field rather than the reading and writing portion.
Yeah.
And then they told me that they didn't accept anyone under 4.0 to get into the nursing program. And there was the percentage of how many students, nursing students that applied to the nursing program. I mean, there were so many of us who were just like, what's next? And you and I were working at the preschool at the time.
I remember that. Yeah.
And I was just devastated because I was just like, I don't know what to do. And through talking with you, I found out that a lot of my prerequisites matched the rec therapy program. And so you're the reason why.
Oh.
Graduated as a rec therapist.
That's awesome. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I remember you being a rec therapist, but I remember you being a nurse and switching over. And so many people did that because they'd get in and it was just too hard to like, they made it really difficult at ASU. Really difficult.
They made it really challenging. And so I'm grateful for it because I loved the rec therapy program. I had so many amazing experiences and, you know, got to do my internship at St. Joe's Neurological Institute, inpatient, and just, you know, got my job afterwards working with kids with special needs. And then I stopped working because I was pregnant with Caden and realized I did not want to put my brand new baby in daycare in Phoenix. We had no connections to have someone watch him. And so,
moved back to Alaska.
Well, that happened in 2008 after I graduated from ASU with a planning degree, urban planning. And I don't know if you remember in 2008, that was the housing bubble and the economy kind of crashed right there. And then in Phoenix, there was all those foreclosures that were happening around the valley across the whole U.S. But there. And so there really wasn't any planning jobs that were available. And we were coming home for 4th of July, and I called up the planning director here in Ketchikan, and I said, hey, I'm coming up. I want to just take you out. I want to know what you recommend for, like, further education or certifications or whatever else. Just get your perspective. Can I take you out to lunch? And he said, how about this? Why don't you send me your resume, and when you come up, we'll do the formal interview, and we'll get you a job here.
Wow.
And he said, if that sounds good to you, we'll get you here. After 4th of July, we got up here. And he goes, okay, so you'll be back here in, 2 weeks? And we were very shocked. We had a brand new baby. We went back down to Arizona and packed up the whole house that we were in. And packed up, got a U-Haul, drove up to Seattle, put it on the barge, and came back here.
Wow.
And we've been here since. And now I'm the kind of worked my way up through the ranks. And now I'm the planning director for the Ketchikan Gateway Borough up here.
That's awesome. Wow.
Yeah. And that's why we're still here. As yes. Sarah would say, we're still stuck here, but
yeah.
I feel very blessed being here. So,
so Richard, going back to you, so you said when you first met Sarah, you didn't know Christ. How did you become a Christian?
So in 07, when we found out that we were pregnant with Sarah, or Sarah was pregnant, and we were with our first child, Sarah had been dragging me to church. And then when we found out that she was pregnant, she said, yeah, no, we're going to church. And I said, oh, okay, yes, ma'am. I guess we're going to church. And so we found a church and we started going. And I'd been to church before, but never actually believed it or believed in it or whatever you want to call it, was a follower. And then the Lord met me. And one Sunday, I told Sarah to go out to the car, and I'd catch up with her. And I went up to the I gave my life to Christ that day. And
wow.
Yeah, so it was and then ever since then, well, I guess then we moved back here. I went through the baptismal classes and got baptized, and been supporting Sarah and follower of Christ since. So that was
awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Very, very cool. Were you nervous dating someone who wasn't a Christian?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
But to be honest with you, when we were dating, I mean, I loved him, but I realized that we were such polar opposites that I really didn't think that we were going to last long. It was a rebellion for me, I think, where actually, to be honest, I was a pretty problematic child when him and I had started dating. I was really good at keeping really good grades, but having a secret life on the weekends and at nighttime. And I was kind of a troublemaker. And I met
Richard. I met Richard
and he was the straight A, like didn't smoke, didn't drink, didn't party.
Soccer player, team captain.
You know, he had dreams of going off to college and I realized the more I was around him that I actually had dreams to get out of this small town. But I really never thought that we would be married because we, our personalities, I don't know if you study the Enneagram at all.
Yes, I do. What are you guys?
I'm a one.
Okay.
Which means that I can be a really difficult person.
And I'm an eight.
Oh, okay.
And so we are either the superhero couple or the atomic bomb couple. So, and it goes both ways.
It's true. They say that we actually Googled a marriage between a one and an eight.
And they're like, don't do it.
And they said that it's the most unlikely pairing out of all of marriages. And they call us fire and ice. And ice. And it is very true. And they say that when we're both healthy, we are the superheroes of the marriages because truth and justice and what's good and right matters. Those are our core beliefs and our personalities. But man, when we are not in sync,
like earlier this week.
Yes.
When she told me about this interview, I was like, yeah, okay. I'm not doing that.
He might've slept on the couch that night. Just FYI. Not because of this interview, but just how awesome we were communicating in quarantine with five children and trying to work from home and go to school from, cause I'm in school and you know, he's working from home and just five kids and 1800 square feet. So
that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, trying to work, you know, and then I got drafted up to the emergency operations center too. So now I'm working in the EOC there, trying to help the community and trying to keep everything up and running. And so it's just been a lot of stress across the plate, everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Big changes, but
definitely.
But yeah, no, we never really thought that we were, that it was going to be a kind of a long-term thing. You know, I didn't realize what it meant, but being unequally yoked was, you know, that was hard for a long time. And then when we did move back to town, we went to her home church. And after a few times of going back to her home church that she grew up in, the pastor there and her mom and a few others were like, "Oh, we've been praying for you for years, Richard. Thank the good Lord that you were saved, because we've been praying for you. Aww. We prayed that you would become a follower and that you would finally come around and see the light. And so you're saved because of us." I was like, "Oh, thanks, guys. Appreciate that."
That is so sweet.
Yeah.
So you guys mentioned your parents. What is it like being parents to five kiddos?
Well, kind of the backstory is, before we got married, I knew that having children was going to be a struggle. I was diagnosed with endometriosis at the age of 15.
Oh, yeah.
And so they actually did surgery on my body to remove scar tissue in my uterus. And at the age of 15, I was told by the gynecologist, they said, "Your left ovary is so covered in scar tissue that I couldn't even remove it because you're so young."
Wow.
So they were only able to remove all the scar tissue everywhere else. And she said, "Getting pregnant is going to be a really big struggle for you." You know, so I'm hearing this at 15, where at that point you're not even thinking about kids and marriage and all that stuff. And I just kind of sat there and didn't really listen all that well. It didn't really hit me. But I remember her saying that if I was going to have children, I would most likely need to have drugs. I would have to have another surgery to remove scar tissue because the scar tissue builds up. And so she just said, you know, you need to be prepared for that. So when we got married, I told Richard, I was like, you need to be aware that this might be a struggle. And when we moved to Arizona, Richard had actually had a health issue and he had to go see a doctor. And we were newly married. I was sitting in the room and the doctor said to Richard, "I don't know if you're going to be able to have kids." And I remember walking out of that appointment going, okay, I thought I was going to be the broken one, but now hearing my husband is potentially going to be unable to produce as well. It was really hard to hear that.
It is. It's really hard. And so young for you guys both.
Yeah, we were in our early 20s, you know, and just kind of like, wow, this is crazy. We can't believe it. And so Richard had actually told me, you know, I don't want to do adoption. I'm fine. We'll raise dogs. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Dogs and kids are not the same thing. I'm sorry. Yeah. No.
This is before I was saved.
Yeah.
So
actually when we got pregnant with Caden, that was really the thing that drove this desire for me to go be with God.
Cause it only took like a month.
No, it did not.
Very short period of time. I said, well, let's give it a try. And
no. we actually decided to start trying in November. It was Thanksgiving Day. That's how I can remember that. And we didn't get pregnant with Caden until June. So it was, you know, it was months of us just kind of seeing what was going to happen. But during that time, I actually started praying the prayer of Hannah, where she's praying for Samuel.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, my husband's not a believer at this point. So this is, I'm really just feeling the whole spiritual burden of, okay, I've got to go to God. Like, I need to consecrate my heart. I need to step in and do this. And so every day I just prayed Hannah's prayer. I said, God, if you give me a son, I was very specific.
Yeah.
That God, if you give me a son, I will give him back to you and I will go back into the church and I will never look back. Like, I will consecrate my whole life to you. And that was just my daily prayer. And when I got pregnant, I was actually very early in my pregnancy, still kind of in that phase of, you know, are we going to get out of that miscarriage window?
Yeah.
And I was laying on the couch in our living room in Phoenix, and it was a Sunday. And God just pressed it on my heart. He said, hey, you know, you made this promise to me. You're pregnant. You have a baby inside of you growing. Yet you're not in the house of God. You're not worshiping me. You're not praying. You're not living this out. And that was when I came to Richard and said, I need you to come to church with me. You don't have to believe. You don't have to sing the songs. I just want you to sit with me because I don't want to sit alone in a church in huge Phoenix. Yeah. So that actually, the miraculous birth of this child that we were told would never happen, happened. And that's what drove us to go back, or drove me to go back to God and introduced Richard to his faith. So having 5 kids is kind of crazy because
we got good at it really quick.
Really? Yeah. Did they come quickly?
They did. We actually,
about 2 years between each kid.
Okay.
But after, so when we got pregnant with our daughter who has cystic fibrosis,
our second child,
she's our second child. And when we got pregnant with her, we never did any genetic testing because we just really believed whatever God gave us is what we were going to have.
Yeah.
Like, we were just going to trust him. So, you know, when they're telling you, oh, you should do an amnio, you should do it. And we're like, no, like, we don't care. Whatever God gives us. And so when Ezra was born the day after Christmas in 2009, it was very clear that something was wrong with her. Her stomach was swollen. It was like having a watermelon and a little tiny head and little tiny arms and legs coming out. Like she was very sick. She was very fragile. And we found out 8 hours after her birth. Her birth was very traumatic because when you have a baby that has a disfigured body, it was very traumatic.
Yeah.
So we found out 8 hours after I had her that she had to be life flighted out.
Wow.
And we're in this little tiny small community in Ketchikan, Alaska. We don't have a NICU. We don't have specialists. So they prepared us and said, tomorrow morning, you guys are going to get life flighted out and you're going to get sent to Seattle Children's Hospital. And your baby is very sick and we don't know if she's going to make it.
That is a lot to hear.
And we had a 19-month-old little boy that we're trying to figure out, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Because they could only put one parent on the medevac flight. And my doctor at the time did not want to release me because my body was not recovering well from the traumatic birth. I kept passing out when I would stand up. So he released me against medical orders. And Richard frantically went home to go and pack up what he could think to grab. And he loaded the plane with our 19-month-old son, and we went down to Children's, and she had emergency life-saving surgery at 2 days old.
Wow, what kind of surgery did they do?
So she had a bowel obstruction, because babies in utero will, after 23 weeks, they start producing meconium, and they pass it. Their digestive tract passes it. Because of her cystic fibrosis and her inability to break down carbohydrates, fats, and proteins, she could not digest all of the nutrients she was getting through the umbilical cord. So that was why her stomach was so full, was she had a bowel obstruction. She had, all of her intestines were just full of undigested meconium.
Now, at the beginning, and when we got medevac down, they didn't know what was wrong. They didn't know she had cystic fibrosis. They didn't know if she had, what she had, a bowel obstruction. They thought her bowels were actually not connected. Mm-hmm. They thought they were, that they had been severed or they just never had been completed. And so that was, so we were just learning on the fly.
Yeah.
You know, new parents, you know, with a 1.5-year-old. And, you know, and he was such a sweet kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was really, it was really nice to, cut our teeth as being parents with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then with this craziness that happened, trying to learn all the jargon, trying to learn all the medical stuff. And then they started doing all the testing. Once they had fixed the bowel obstruction, they did the genetic testing to find out what was wrong with her. And that was when they found out she had cystic fibrosis. And when we first met the first cystic fibrosis doctor, he walked in and what was his nickname?
Dr. Death.
He walked in with his resident or whatever, and he goes, just so you know, there's a very high probability that your daughter will not make it, and she won't live to be past the age of 13 or
30
at the time, I guess it was, and just gave us all these horrible statistics. And we're all just, both of us were just sitting there going, wait, what? What just happened? And so that's how we have learned. That was how we learned about cystic fibrosis.
That's an awful way to find out.
It is. It was awesome. But being parents now, as your first question was, being parents to 5 kids, It can be challenging at times, but it's a lot of fun. We really enjoy all the kids most of the time. And, you know, they're a handful, but they all get along and they're all so close in age that each one of them has a buddy. It was really cute, actually, just yesterday. The two youngest come out of their bedroom after getting dressed, and they came out and they said, "Daddy, look, we're matching." And they had exactly the same outfits on. And then we pulled up Facebook, and 6 years prior, our other two daughters, the two older daughters, they had done the exact same thing 6 years ago. So, you know, it was kind of cool for, you know, the Lord reminded us, or Facebook reminded us, that, you know, that they're all kind of partnered up. And so we have one boy who's our oldest, and then four girls.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Wow. So, you know, I'm not looking forward to the teenage years, you know, when there's five ladies in the house that are all going strong together. My son and I we're going to have to bail somewhere. We're going to be camping in the yard or something. So
I love it. So dealing with Ezra's CF, how did that kind of like shake or form your faith? Like how did, like just hearing, did you know about what CF was before she even had it? Like, was there any signs?
Yeah. So, after they did surgery for her, and when we got down there, actually it was midnight by the time the surgeons came to prepare us for her life-saving surgery. So it's midnight and they had done all these scans and they said, you know, looking at your baby, she's very sick. And what we think is that her intestines just stopped forming together because they had taken all these scans. What they didn't realize at that time was it was a bowel obstruction, because CF is typically a Caucasian disease. So they were looking at me and they're going, oh, you know, they just kind of dismissed it. They didn't even think to go that direction. And I, as time went on, I mean, we didn't find out Ezzy had CF until she was 3 weeks old. So at this time, you know, we're spending 3 weeks in the hospital. They're living, my husband and our 20-month-old was living in Ronald McDonald House. Okay. And, you know, we're just waiting, like the doctors can't tell us what's happening. And they started to slowly bring up the idea, hey, this could be a genetic disease, but you know, we're going to have to do some testing. And they had dropped the word cystic fibrosis, and immediately everything crumbled in me. And I don't know why, but I don't know if you ever watched the movie or the TV show Touched by an Angel.
Yeah, I remember watching that as a kid. Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember this episode with Winona Ryder being on there, and she had a little boy with CF, and she sang this beautiful song, All the Colors of the Rainbows, and her child is passed away from it, and he was young. And I, in that moment, was like, oh, dear Lord, this cannot be happening. So we waited in fear to get those test results back. And it was very alarming because, you know, we get the results back and the doctor comes in and just gives us no hope. And, you know, he told us, he said, you're going to stand over your child's grave and there will be nothing that you can do about it.
What kind of doctor is that? Oh, my gosh.
I think, to be honest with you, I think they kept looking at these very young parents. And I think what I've learned after talking with our team is that so many parents don't take this disease seriously. Mm-hmm. They don't follow all of the recommendations of therapy schedules, or, you know, they don't follow this whole crisis right now that the world's living in with the COVID of social distancing and 6 feet apart and hand washing, you know, all these things. That's the life of a CF family without a pandemic.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And so I think what they were doing was they sent in that doctor because they wanted this young family to understand the severity of this disease.
Okay.
And so I don't fault him for doing that because it really spoke to the magnitude of what we were going to be facing. And I will be honest with you, Alexis, that I was very angry with God. I stopped praying, and, you know, Rich would pray over the family meals in Ronald McDonald House or the hospital cafeteria, and I wouldn't pray. I was just angry. And it went on for a couple of days, and Richard looked at me and he was like, "You've got to stop. Like, we need you. We need you to be in this. You always have the faith, and you don't have it right now." And it actually came with a very hard conversation with my mom, because I ended up getting the flu when we were down there, and so I couldn't go see her in the NICU.
Oh, that's hard.
And so I'm laying in bed crying because I've got this little tiny baby that's recovering from surgery. I can't go see her. Just completely feeling like I'm in the desert.
Yeah.
And my mom, I called my mom because I knew that I could be vulnerable with her. And instead of getting the, "Oh, baby girl, I'm so sorry," my mom gave me a really hard talk. And she said, "Sarah, you can take this opportunity and realize that Ezra can be your chance to share God's message to the nation, or you can sit in your hotel bed and cry your eyes out and feel sorry for yourself."
Yeah.
And she just said, "This Ezra is a door for you to share hope to the people that don't have hope." And that really resonated with me, where I was realizing, okay, this situation sucks. I have a sick baby. They're telling us that she's not going to live a normal life like everyone else. All those dreams of watching her graduate from high school and go to college and get married and have babies and grow old, all of that's gone. And that was a really formative moment for me to realize that even in all of this pain and unknown, that God was inviting me into the wilderness to grow my faith in Him.
Wow, yeah. He really was.
And He's been faithful. I mean, Ezra, when we sent it out, Facebook was so new in 2009.
Yeah,
people were still using MySpace.
Oh my gosh, yes.
They were still using MySpace. So when we think about technology and how, like, you can sign on Facebook or social media and you can be immediately connected to a family in a crisis.
Yeah.
This was very new for Facebook. And I started journaling and just sharing my thoughts and what God was bringing us through. And every single time we asked for prayer, we were humbled to realize that there were people across the nation praying for our baby, because so-and-so called their prayer warrior aunt in New Hampshire, and they were praying for this little tiny baby Ezra that they had never met.
Wow.
And God just really showed me the power of faith and the power of prayer through Ezra's life, because she's been given so many grim diagnoses or prognoses, and she's defied them.
Yeah.
She's defied them, where when moments have gotten very scary, God has been very clear to us that we're not supposed to walk this journey alone. And so we weigh the times of when we want to ask for prayer, because something that we've learned is, by being in this journey for so long, crises aren't as big as they used to be.
Okay.
You know, every single time she gets sick, we don't go into high alert, everyone needs to gather around and pray for us. We kind of hunker down. We're just learning. I mean, hospitalizations, like, we kind of just learned when is the right time to bring people into our crisis.
Okay.
And one point on that, we're not very good at receiving help.
Mm-hmm.
We're not very good at, just because of our personalities, you know, 1 in 8, we're like,
we've got it.
Yeah, we're good. Thanks. Yeah.
We are dying over here. Yes. We cannot figure out how to feed our children, but no, don't bring us dinner. We're good.
Yeah. And even prayer, where, you know, people will be like, "Well, what can we do?" And we're like, just pray for us. And like, go away, leave us alone.
Yeah.
We're hunkering down.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we struggle with that. That's one of our biggest struggles, is letting people in and getting the word out. And so if we do let people in, and we put it out there on Facebook, or
you
put
should
it
know
out,
it's
so.
Pretty bad if we're yeah. doing that.
Okay.
If you're seeing a plea from the Harneys, "Hey, we need prayer," it means most likely that we've trekked along for days or possibly weeks, and we're now realizing, "Oh my gosh, we can't do this on our own.
Yeah.
We need people praying for her."
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. We're kind of pains.
We're difficult people.
Being difficult people. We can be. I mean, but God has given us this. God has given us so many opportunities to let himself be known.
Okay.
In this process. Absolutely.
How does Ezzy deal with her illness? Like, and it, like explaining it to her friends, to her siblings, how does she cope with it?
You know, I think she's like every single other 10-year-old child. I mean, moody 10-year-old girl, right? Like, I mean, when you think about tweens, she's absolutely a tween right now.
Mm-hmm.
She, you know, when she was growing up, I remember very clearly that I had to be careful sharing her story. And so mm-hmm. when you're in a small community and people know who she is, you know, it's a small island, people would talk about her as if she wasn't there when she was in our presence. And so God really put it on my heart. Hey, Sarah, when you do that, you should be turning to her and saying, hey, Ezra, can we talk about this? You know, so I started doing that with her when she was probably around five years old. Okay. Like when she was becoming socially aware that people were talking about her. And to be honest with you, there were times where she's like, no. And so then I would have to turn to the adult and say, I'm sorry, I can't talk about this right now. But then they would see that I was honoring her in her space.
Yeah, definitely.
As she's gotten older, she's done really well with sharing her story. You know, she tells people about it. And again, because we're in a small island, most people know her story at this point, because every single year when she has a brand new classroom and a brand new teacher, we send out a letter to the families in her classroom and say, hey, you have a child that has CF in the classroom. So if you send your child sick to school, you know, you're putting her at risk.
Right.
So what we're asking as her parents is call us and say, hey, I'm sending my sick kid to school. So that way we won't send Ezra to school.
Okay.
So she's learning the importance of advocating for herself now. We're really trying to put some of that responsibility on her. And I would not say that it's something that she is ashamed of.
Okay.
But it is something that I know that is scary for her, because the virus situation that we're in right now has definitely got to her.
I can imagine.
Because
if, say, she caught this virus, it'd be devastating for her, wouldn't it, because of her lungs?
Yes.
Yeah.
We don't, it's so hard because to date, there has, to our knowledge, there's been no CF child that's gotten the virus across the nation to date that we understand. And we talk to her team on a pretty regular basis. So it's really hard because there's no data showing how CF patients will handle this virus.
Okay.
All we have is that people with compromised immune systems or respiratory issues do not fare well. So that's all that we have going forward with this pandemic that we're facing.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, people with CF and the caregivers of CFers, we all learned how to wash our hands.
Yeah.
We all got it when we first had to start dealing with CF, you know, coughing into the elbow. Like, this is a new thing for people. It's like, what? What's wrong with you people? Did you not pass preschool? You know, so that's something that I think, you know, and when this thing all hit, we were like, all right, hunker down. Like, we didn't need to wait for the governor or the president to say, hey, y'all should hunker down. And I think across the nation, CFers and their caregivers were like, we're not leaving the house, you know?
Yeah.
And that's just something that we've been dealing with for a long time. You know, we've all lived this. You know, flu season comes around, and with Ezzy, every February, March, she gets a really bad infection and she gets a really bad cold or flu or whatever it is. And she has to increase her treatments. She has to take antibiotics for a month. And usually she is out of school for at least a couple weeks. And sometimes she has to go to the hospital to get a tune-up.
Okay.
And, you know, that's just been our life. And that's just been how we've had to deal with CF. And so this is, you know, she actually started, when this whole thing started, she was on antibiotics. She had gotten a cold. And then one of our other children got flu B, And so we all started Tamiflu immediately, which is an antiviral to stop or to help prevent the flu from spreading into our family and then also to Ezzie. And so we were already on antivirals and she was on antibiotics, and we were already in that hunker down phase when everything started blowing up and the virus hit Washington.
So
it's been rough, and she gets it. She gets it, and the rest of the family for the most part gets it too. The rest of the kids, they understand the importance of it. And the first couple days of isolation were pretty rough on our oldest. But he understands and he gets it. And our friends and family here in Ketchikan, they've all really rallied around us and have helped us. And that was a big deal for us to have so much support.
Yeah, definitely.
And when the virus first came to Ketchikan, and that's what the video that we posted on our Facebook page, which was really just an update for our Team Ezzie friends and family. It didn't mean for it to go viral, if I can even use that word anymore. But it just kind of caught on, and, you know, I got exposed. Potentially, I had been exposed by two people at my work, which was the first case in Ketchikan. One of the guys was traveling, and he while all this was happening in Washington and Portland, and he brought it back to the community. And so now everybody's been kind of reeling from that one kind of data point or whatever. And there's been a couple others traveling too. So that really rocked our world, because then we were trying to figure out, well, did I get it?
Yeah.
Was I exposed? Was I, you know, how's this going to reel in our family? And how are we going to deal with this? But thank the good Lord, we're on day 12, mm-hmm. day 12 now. And no symptoms.
That is really good.
Yeah, so we feel pretty blessed in that aspect. Still 2 days of quarantine, but yeah.
Man, wow. All right, so I wanted to ask you guys, what are your goals for this year? For your family, for yourselves, what are some of your big goals?
Survive the virus? Not run out of toilet paper?
Is it crazy there too with the toilet paper thing? Like, is I don't
it
know
was.
Why toilet paper? Why?
It's just crazy.
People are crazy.
It's
actually, I think our community is starting to get, they're aware that this is something we need to take seriously. So yeah. It got crazy for a little while, and now it's just kind of, I think people are figuring out this rhythm. And I have to say, I have to give kudos to a lot of people in our community that even if we don't per se know them, when we put that video out telling people, you know, Richard's been exposed, we need prayer for Ezra, it was shocking to me how many healthy families chose to go into isolation.
Wow.
Where they were just like, we have to flatten the curve for Ezra.
Yeah.
And that was just really encouraging. I have to say that, that blew our mind with how many people just, I mean, we put that video out and that night someone dropped off bleach and toilet paper on our doorstep.
Oh, that's so sweet.
You know, it was just crazy that the community did that. But going to our goals, sadly enough, we were actually just getting ready to purchase our family trip tickets to Hawaii.
Oh.
Our goal was that we were going to be going in November as a family. We've made it a goal. And this is something that we've learned from other CF families where they say it's really important to create memories with your kids.
Yeah.
Because of the unknown.
Yeah.
And we try really hard not to live in that part. We don't like to talk about the mortality of it because we don't know where it's going to be.
Yeah.
But one of the things they said to do is to really get your family pictures done and take vacations, which... that's really hard to do when you're a family of seven. That's really expensive.
Yeah.
Although now it might be cheap to buy tickets. I was looking the other day. It's really cheap to buy plane tickets.
Now's the time to go travel.
Yeah.
We were getting ready to purchase tickets, and then our CF center got a hold of all the families and said, no travel for CF families or patients. So that was a little hard for us because we had been telling all the kids, you know, when they were like, oh, we want to go out and eat, or, oh, we want to go get this. And we're like, no, we're putting that money in for the Hawaii trip. That's been hard for us. So we're still coming to grips with that because, saving up to have us travel takes about 2 to 3 years for us of saving.
Yeah.
So that way we can go to a family vacation together. So that was a goal for us this year. And who knows, we might be able to go, you know, we might be able to stay here in 4 or 5 months that it's safe and we can travel. I think one of the goals for us just as a family is,
not kill each other.
I mean, that's a really meaningful goal to have every day, but we try really hard to make time for our kids because, you know, we do both work and I go to school. And so we wanted to really make sure that this summer we didn't overcommit ourselves because we, Richard and I, have a tendency to do that.
Yeah.
Hey, we got 5 minutes of free time. What should we fill it with?
Yeah. we are high functioning doers. That is, we'll get the job done.
Yeah.
But our goal, we actually were telling our kids that this summer was we wanted to fish as much as possible, and stock up on subsistence foods with the kids. So that was one of the goals that we had, is we just said, hey, this summer, we're not going to overcommit ourselves.
Okay.
And when the weather's nice, we're going to get in the boat. And we're gonna go fish, and we're gonna gather seaweed, and we're gonna berry pick, and you know, make jams. You know, just that's a goal for us, is to really teach our kids how to learn how to live off of the land.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Can you think of any goals?
No, all of our goals kind of got shot up with the virus. So
yeah.
No, that was pretty much it. Just not to overcommit and to. Mm-hmm. Last summer we were doing soccer. I was coaching soccer, and it was four times a week, all summer long, with traveling to different tournaments and whatever else. And it was a lot on our family. Mm-hmm. And so this year I told the club that I wasn't going to be coaching, and it was just to try to become more of a family and have family time.
Yeah.
And so really, I think, you know, as horrible as this whole quarantine thing is, it's giving us a chance to figure out that we do like each other,
yeah.
I think, and that we do have, you know, we can be just a family together, and we don't need outside influences to distract us from each other. And so we're just trying really hard to have family time and, you know, have the kids, you know, learn each other, like just get to know each other. And so that's been, so this is kind of a kickoff, for one of our goals from last year, of just getting to, you know, have family time, quality time.
Yeah, definitely. Well, what are you guys loving right now?
So, I have to tell you, what are we loving?
Loving.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, we used to do family devotions pretty regularly. And then I started going to school, which typically is in the evening hours.
Yeah.
Or a lot of ministry commitments that I have are in the evening hours. And then my husband, or Richard, had ministry commitments on and off in the evening hours. And it was so interesting because we were always so busy worrying about feeding the people.
Yeah.
And then we would come home and we'd be tapped out. And so family devotions petered off in our lives, which makes me really sad to say that, you know, that we were so busy worrying about how to feed people in our church community. And then we'd come home and be like, oh, we're done. You guys need to go to bed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's been really great to have family devotions back in our routine, that every night, you know, we're gathering around and we're reading scripture, or we're doing a devotion together and we're praying. And actually, it was just really cool to to invite the kids in when we first learned that Richard was exposed to this. They could sense our fear, even though we weren't saying it. And that night when we asked all of them to pray, it was so profound to hear what a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, and an 8-year-old could pray for.
Yeah.
Like to realize that they have a tangible relationship with God in their own ways. And their prayers were so spot on, where I was like, okay, God, like, you can use this super scary situation and actually grow their faith in this process as well. So I'm loving that. I'm loving the prayer time, the Bible study time with them. That's been really great to have.
Another guest and I were saying that earlier, like, even though, like, this virus sucks, the way it's wiped out all the extra things and given you time to slow down and kind of see what matters has been kind of the blessing in it.
It has been.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. It has been.
Yeah. And I had actually just read on Facebook, it was a little excerpt from C.S. Lewis's
Screwtape Letters.
Yeah, Screwtape Letters. And it was interesting, and he said, you know, Satan says, you know, I'm going to cause fear and anxiousness, and I'm going to shut down the church, and I'm going to do all these things. And I'm totally butchering it, but that's okay.
He is.
And then Jesus replies, and he goes, well, I'll take what you're going to try for evil and make it good and bring back the family dinners, and I'll bring back the family devotion time and the praying and get rid of all the worldly things and make everybody remember who I am. And, you know, from where I sit and what I see, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, it sure is making, saying, hey, I'm going to be praying for you to my coworkers and things like that, who don't necessarily have a relationship, never been to church, don't believe. And I told one of them, one of the guys that had been exposed, I said, hey, just so you know, my kids are praying for you and your wife every single night. And he's not a believer. And he was like, thanks. I really appreciate that. That's awesome. You know, and it was, you know, I don't know what the Lord's going to do in his heart, and I don't know how the Lord's going to meet him, but you know, if that can just be that little mustard seed that is planted.
Yeah, sometimes it's all it takes. It's just that one little thing.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you guys so much. We're at the end of our time. You guys did awesome. Well,
thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fun.
We had fun. Thank it was you. Nice touching base with you after all these years.
I know. It's been so long. It shouldn't be this long next time.
No, you look the same, by the way.
I know, so do you. So you guys both do.
I age, Alexis. I have got gray hair.
I don't see them at all.
They are there.
You know, and it's actually kind of funny because a lot of people I've been talking with, they all have been saying very similar things. They're like, you know, I've not talked to these people forever.
Yeah.
But now, because I'm not allowed to go out of my house, I'm reaching out with these people. I'm having happy hours. I'm having these virtual connections, these conversations with people that I haven't talked with in years. And it's just, to me, that's interesting. So.
Yeah, it's really awesome. It's been kind of the nice thing that comes out of this is I feel like we were all so plugged into our stuff earlier.
Yep.
And now it's like people want to connect. People want to see friends and want to get out. Like I was driving the other day and people, even though they've told us to like not be together, I see people outside walking, kids riding their bikes, people taking walks. And it's just like you never saw that before, like a few months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you.
No problem. Thanks, you guys. All right.
Guys, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Brave Podcast. I really hope you enjoyed my interview with Sarah and Richard. If you want to find out more about them, I'll include their Instagram, Facebook, any info on CF. And it's actually National CF Month, so it's a perfect time for this interview to air. So I'll include all info about that in the show notes so you can find out more. And I have my three asks. First, download. Downloading the episode kind of lets the podcast host and world out there know that it's a show that you like, and it kind of gives it more exposure. It also helps you out. So if you want to download the episode, listen to it later, you won't have to worry about being on Wi-Fi. It's already there ready for you. Second is ratings. Ratings helps me know what you're loving about the show and what I need to work on. And it also helps get the podcast exposure. So definitely when you have a chance, shoot out a rating. I super appreciate it. And then finally, oh, I blanked on the last one. Oh my gosh, you guys, share. Oh my gosh, share the episode with a friend. If you hear something you like, sharing the episode is the best way to get the word out there. So definitely if you like what you're hearing, share the episode. All right. Next week, you're going to love my guest. It's Sherman Burkhead. He's written a book on distraction, which is something I think we can all relate to. And it was such a great read. I seriously just kind of flew through it. Like, it was hard to, like, read that and then try to go to bed at the same time. It was just really great info, and you're going to love our interview. So be sure to tune into that interview next week. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, and I will see you next time. Bye.